You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, can public officials block followers on their social media accounts? There's a lawsuit against the president on that very issue, and our guest says it could set a major precedent.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Wednesday, a federal appeals court upheld Wisconsin's so-called right-to-work law. The law prohibits mandatory union membership and prevents unions and employers from requiring non-members to pay dues.
Jonathan Anderson joins us now to share the details of that and some other top Wisconsin news from the past week. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Stevens Point. Jonathan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with this right-to-work ruling. Was this decision a surprise to anyone involved?
I'm not sure it was a surprise. A lower court had made the same decision. As you said at the beginning, there was this federal appeals court in Chicago, which is an intermediary appellate court in the federal court system, and it found that the state's right-to-work law was permissible. And that was something that a lower court judge had found, I think, last year.
Who had brought this case in the first place?
Yeah, so who brought it was a labor union, two chapters of a labor union, the International Union of Operating Engineers. They had sued the state, arguing that it was essentially unconstitutional to prevent them from collecting money to cover their costs for representing the non-union workers.
Right, the idea in the challenge, the argument unions make is they do things that provide benefits to non-members, so they should be able to levy fine or fees, I guess, from non-members too, which right to work doesn't allow them to do. Was that pretty much the core of their argument?
Yeah, that was the core. But the judges certainly they have not had luck at convincing a judge to do that or to accept that argument. And it's that's not entirely surprising because Indiana has a very similar law, and the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which covers both Indiana and Wisconsin, essentially validated the Indiana law as well. And the ruling on Wisconsin was largely based on that Indiana case.
So the right to work law in Wisconsin has been in effect and stays in effect. Is that right?
That's right, yep.
And is there any plan for an appeal of the decision to a still higher court?
So we don't know that at this point, but we know that one of the union's attorneys told the Wisconsin State Journal that they were considering their options. So they could potentially ask the U.S. Supreme Court to review the case.
Talking to Jonathan Anderson from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at a few of the top stories in Wisconsin news, something a lot of people have had their eye on, Jonathan, Foxconn, this big technology company looking to open some kind of factory in the United States, maybe Wisconsin. So everybody's watching for signs in Wisconsin that they might be looking at Wisconsin more so than other states. What have we seen over the last week?
Yeah, it's been a really interesting week on this front. A lot has happened. People who are maybe closely watching this will know that there's this private jet that has been linked to Foxconn, and it was spotted at airports in both Milwaukee and Madison over the last week. And we also know from various news reports that Foxconn executives have traveled the state and have met with public officials, both local and state, and also have had conversations with federal officials, including there was a barbecue at the governor's mansion with Governor Scott Walker and other major top leaders of the state government who had attended this and had met with senior executives from the company. There have also been sort of local meetings where Foxconn could potentially build one, in particular in Racine County. There was a meeting of a couple of local governments there to discuss a potential development project. So all of those things have kind of coalesced into speculation that maybe Foxconn is seriously looking at Wisconsin to build this factory.
And talk about what's at stake, the scope of, at least in theory, what Foxconn could be building.
Yeah, the company, has said that, you know, it is looking at spending upwards of $10 billion on new U.S. factories. And, you know, the big thing is jobs. I mean, they've said that these factories could employ thousands of people, and that would certainly inject a real sort of boost for the economic prospects of people in the state.
Now, in addition to throwing some brats on the grill, there is some talk of the state trying to do something in a legislative way to help lure Foxconn here. Other states are throwing their stakes into the pot, too. What kind of things are we hearing this week?
So, I mean, one thing, for example, in Michigan was that the House of Representatives there approved tax incentives. I think upwards of or close to $200 million. So, I mean, you know, that's the kind of legislative action that could be required to attract a massive company like Foxconn and what it can provide to the state. But details are not clear about, you know, what Wisconsin might be doing or what could potentially happen.
And I should make it clear, I don't know that brats were on the menu at that cookout. I'm just, hypothetically, it was brats. So do we have any kind of indication of the timeline here on when a decision could be made?
No, but what I can say is that one of the reasons that observers think that Foxconn is looking at the U.S. is to protect against potential trade barriers from the President Donald Trump's administration. So, you know, to the extent that those, you know, may get, you know, we see more on that front, that could potentially spur action on Foxconn's side.
And finally, some new research on how bears eat in Wisconsin. And it turns out humans have more to do with it than I think researchers would like. What do we know about this?
Yeah, this is really interesting. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported this week that there is a newly released study that found that bait made up more than 40% of the diet of bears harvested in northern Wisconsin, I think in particular black bears. And they found that the bait included foods that, you know, have a large amount of high fructose corn syrup, like donuts or candy, which, you know, have a lot of calories for the bears. And that's important, they said, that it's important for the bears because consuming, you know, calorically dense foods can mean that the bears are more apt to survive and potentially can produce more cubs.
And that could lead to questions about are there places in the state where there are too many bears, is that right?
Yeah, they did look at, they did look at sort of the density of the bear population in the state. And, you know, it's not really clear whether the DNR may use this information to change hunting regulations for the state. The Journal Sentinel reported that they likely would not rewrite their management plan for bears because of this study. But they did find it interesting, you know, of how humans, you know, may be affecting the bear population.
We'll leave it there for now. Jonathan, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Sure, thank you.
That was Jonathan Anderson, reporter for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. He's based in Stevens Point. He joined us to look back at the week's biggest stories in our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup.
If you have a social media account on Facebook or Twitter, say, you may have blocked or unfriended someone, maybe for personal reasons, maybe for a disagreement over politics. It's just part of the social media world for everyday users.
But what if you're not an everyday user? You're an elected public official and you use your social media platform to talk policy and politics. Can you block whoever you want to from accessing your posts?
That question is at the center of a lawsuit filed against President Trump and two of his staff. The president is a big Twitter user, and on his personal account, Real Donald Trump, he's blocked a number of people who have challenged his policies and behavior. A group of those blocked users have filed a lawsuit represented by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. They say their First Amendment rights have been violated.
Our next guest says this case could have implications for other levels of government and social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, and maybe ones that don't even exist yet. Morgan Weiland joins us now. She's a First Amendment and media lawyer and scholar at Stanford University. Morgan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, for starters, Morgan, what's the argument from these blocked Twitter users in this lawsuit against the president?
Well, as you rightly pointed out in your intro, these Twitter users who have been blocked, who are from a variety of different states across the country and who are being represented by the Knight Institute at Columbia University, are arguing that their First Amendment rights are being violated because they're not able to engage with the president on Twitter. And that argument turns on a key legal question, which is whether or not Donald Trump's Twitter account amounts to a public forum. What's a public forum? Essentially, every town square that we've ever enjoyed, we've ever walked through, even sidewalks, those are public forums. They're government property that are open to the public where anyone can speak and say whatever they'd like without any sort of discrimination based on their viewpoint. Now, the argument that the Twitter users, the Block users, and the Knight Institute are advancing in this particular case is that Donald Trump's personal Twitter account is, in fact, also a public forum. And that's the key legal question that the Southern District of New York will have to deal with.
And what's been the basic response from the White House on this?
My understanding is that they haven't responded to this question. I know that the Knight Institute sent a letter before they filed this lawsuit, and there was no response. According to Columbia University, there was no response from the White House about this particular issue. But I think what's particularly interesting, and there is a good counterargument, even if the White House hasn't yet made it, I think an interesting counterargument against the lawsuit is that Donald Trump's actually using his personal Twitter account. There are multiple Twitter accounts that he has access to. One of them is the one that was handed down from Barack Obama, which is the official White House Twitter account. The one that is at issue is, as you pointed out, his personal Twitter account. And so the counterargument would be that he's speaking in his capacity as a private citizen, that he has the right to offer his opinions about whatever he's like as a private citizen, and that there is no First Amendment interest that's implicated because he's not acting as a government official. Now, I think, you know, personally, I think that argument is vulnerable because, as we've seen, President Trump has used the @RealDonaldTrump account, even though it was created initially in his capacity as a private citizen. He's used it to talk about and advance policies and practices of the presidency. So I think that will be their best argument, but I do think that the blocked Twitter users have a good claim to make.
If I were a public official and I just used, say, my Twitter feed or Facebook page for that matter, just to show, you know, pictures of puppies and kittens and the meals I eat and that sort of thing, would I be in a different argument in blocking someone than if I used it to lay out my policy proposals?
I think that's absolutely right. And the reason is that the public forum doctrine and the whole point of the First Amendment that's implicated here is to ensure that spaces where public discourse about political questions that are happening between politicians, public officials, and citizens and voters is open, and that individuals are not being discriminated against just because they disagree with what a politician has to say. And that's really a key problem in this case. President Trump has been blocking people who disagree with him. And as the public forum doctrine makes really clear, the whole point of ensuring that these sorts of spaces, whether they're virtual spaces like a Twitter account or they're real-world spaces like a sidewalk, the whole point of ensuring that these spaces are open is to ensure that there's active and robust dialogue between public officials and citizens, and that that dialogue does not involve discrimination based on a citizen's viewpoint. So if I'm a Democrat and I disagree with Donald Trump, and I say so, I shouldn't be discriminated against just because I hold a different view.
Are we in kind of uncharted legal territory here with all this politics, First Amendment stuff on a social media forum, or is this a pretty easy analogy to make with the last 200 years of American government?
It's a really important question. I think, you know, I'm here at Stanford in the heart of Silicon Valley, and I think we get very excited about new types of technologies, and in many instances, new technologies are game-changing in terms of the law. But I think in this particular case, there's an important through line in terms of democratic principles, which is we need to make sure as a country that we hold forums that government officials use open in a non-discriminatory way to citizens. And that applies regardless of whether the space is virtual or not. So I think that we should not get distracted by the shiny new object that can be, new technologies. I sometimes it matters, but I think that it's much less important in this particular case.
Talking to Morgan Weiland from Stanford University. She's a scholar on the First Amendment and media, looking at a lawsuit against President Trump and a couple of his advisors over blocking people from the real Donald Trump Twitter account if they disagree with his views. This may have implications beyond this particular case. And let's talk about those implications, Morgan. I mean, this is obviously a high-profile issue with the president and his Twitter. Where else could this becoming an issue? Where else could this case affect the way public officials behave online?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this case will have sweeping implications regardless of the outcome. As I'm sure many of your listeners know, and they probably all have, Facebook accounts. And Facebook is a place that is increasingly becoming a hub for politicians, just like Twitter is. And Facebook has been rolling out what they call election pages or candidate pages. And I can imagine in the 2018 or 2020 elections that are coming up, candidates having pages that are, you know, an integral part of their voter outreach effort and an integral part of the way that they're conducting their campaigns. And imagine it's just a half step away from what's happening in the Twitter case that we've been discussing. Imagine if the neighbor to your left, Minnesota. Imagine if Senator Al Franken has a Facebook page and he decides, well, you know, I don't really want any Republicans, any voters who are Republicans to be able to be part of my Facebook page. And so they identify everyone on the voter rolls who's a Republican and then block them or exclude them or unfriend them on Facebook. That would be outrageous. And I think that's something that would be very much in line with what we've seen Trump doing, blocking people who disagree with them. And that's the sort of outcome that I think we should be hoping as American citizens to avoid, because that would fundamentally undermine our ability to interact with our elected officials and also potential candidates who we may want to vote for. So I think that the legal issues at stake here could absolutely have implications for a Facebook kind of application going forward, because I think the Facebook example is even more clear. If a politician has a page and says that this is their candidate page or their official page, there should be no question, I think, that that is official, that's a public forum, an official statement that the politician is making.
No, wait, suppose I'm in Congress, I'm Congressman Rob, I've got a Facebook forum for my work as a congressperson. And then over here, I've got a Facebook forum for candidate Rob 2018. Do those get treated differently? Is it easier for me to bar people from my candidate page than my public official page?
I think they should be treated the same way, because the principle of ensuring openness and communication with potential voters should be the same, I think. Now, if you have the interesting hypo, the legal nerd in me is thinking, well, what about the third page that is your Rob the dad and father and husband page? Maybe that page would be private. I think what really matters, and this ties us back to the Trump Twitter lawsuit, the question is how does Rob the candidate, how does Rob use that page? If he has a private page that he effectively uses to talk about politics, well, then let's look at how he's actually using it. Now, if he's just posting pictures of puppies and grandkids, then maybe that actually is a legitimately private space and he deserves some privacy interest in that space.
I keep on thinking of other possibilities. Suppose the Democratic Party or the Republican Party said, hey, we have this page for Democrats or Republicans, and hey, as a bonus for joining in, you get to interact with some of your favorite Democratic or Republican officials. Does the presence of those officials on that page mean, hey, we can't make this a closed room for Republicans or Democrats?
Interesting question. Honestly, I'm not positive exactly what the legal answer to that question would be. Now, if the page was being held out as something that was open, if they weren't a candidate and they were an official and they were holding out this page as a space where this candidate or this official was engaging in a very open discussion about their policies, about a piece of legislation, and they were soliciting feedback, then excluding people based on their party affiliation would definitely be a problem, because, again, that cuts to the purpose of having an open, non-discriminatory public forum, which is allowing citizens to both speak and hear and engage in this back and forth so that they can participate fully as citizens. So I do think that it would be it would be a potential violation. But again, if, you know, if we see candidates, if we see politicians pushing boundaries in this way, I can imagine that we'll see more lawsuits trying to sort of define exactly what the boundaries of the public forum doctrine are online.
I'll stop my thread of off the top of my head hypotheticals now and ask, you know, this is going to the courts, this lawsuit. Is this something where maybe we need legislation to lay things out in a more clear way, or is that just creating more problems?
Well, given the current climate, I'm never very hopeful that legislation will be passed, to be honest. But I think the First Amendment doctrine is robust and addresses the question that Columbia University and the blocked Twitter followers are raising. So I think our courts are perfectly capable of handling this question, and the precedent exists to make to answer the question that's being raised.
And briefly, as we see more people on social media, new kinds of social media, more political use of it, are we going to see more cases like this one, do you think?
I think it's hard to speculate, but I think that as we get a better sense of the virtual world being just an extension of and imbricated with the real world, we will come to understand that the laws in many respects apply as they would if we were talking about a sidewalk or a town square or a town hall that was being opened to citizens to engage with their public officials. So I think maybe finally the law might be catching up with the online reality that we've been living, and hopefully we won't see a total proliferation rather of these types of lawsuits.
It's a good place to leave it. Morgan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Morgan Weiland, First Amendment and media lawyer and scholar at Stanford University, talking about a First Amendment lawsuit against President Trump for blocking Twitter followers.
Now, the 2017 Emmy Award nominations were announced yesterday. Shows like Saturday Night Live and Westworld lead the shows with the most nominations. The year also marks one of the most diverse lineups of nominees in recent years, with shows like Black-ish and Atlanta getting nominations.
And according to our next guest, the field of nominees might reflect what's happening in the collective American psyche, namely that the shows that have captured the imaginations and eyes of the population represent our sometimes tumultuous political and social climate.
Lorraine Ali joins us now. She's a television critic for the Los Angeles Times. Lorraine, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
Well, we've been seeing thumbs up, thumbs down on these nominations. What are your thoughts and takeaways from the 69th Emmy nominations?
Oh, it's always a thumbs up, thumbs down thing, isn't it? it's really interesting. I mean, you know, for many reasons. For one, there's a lot of newcomers here that made it into top categories, like, you know, outstanding drama. There's also like a big win here for streaming services, Netflix, Hulu. And also, I think just overall, and what I had written in my piece is just, you know, the content of the shows that are grabbing a lot of these nominations, like Westworld. They kind of paint this crazy dystopian future, or kind of this, you know, dark direction that America's moving in. And then on the flip side of it, there's other shows that are like these real comfort shows. So it's really interesting. It's like people want to be either comforted or they see their worst fears in television.
Well, let's go into Westworld here for a moment. HBO's remake of Westworld tied for the most nominations at 22. It's about a Wild West amusement park inhabited by robot characters. And let's listen to a scene from the show.
So how does this work? Is there a orientation?
No orientation. No guidebook. Figuring out how it works is half the fun. All you do is make choices. Starting here, everything is bespoke and exactly your size. You want to ask, so ask.
Are you real?
Well, if you can't tell, does it matter?
What's the appeal here? Why did it Westworld walk away with so many nominations?
Well, one of the things is the premise that Westworld works off is it kind of takes our you know, kind of collective obsession with media and entertainment and instant gratification. And it sets it against this world where humans are going in there and trying to get all that from robots. So I think it pairs that kind of obsession with entertainment with that old Western theme, which you would think, you know, now, well, like, who really wants to see a Western? But think about it, like, Deadwood, you know, is really one of the shows, and that was a Western show on HBO that, like, kicked off all these premium cable shows. So I think it combines those two things. And also, even though they're robots, they say a lot more about human nature than the actual human beings in the show.
Yeah, there is so much variety. You've got robots, you've got family drama, political satire, handmaids. Right. There is so much here, Lorraine. How are you supposed to digest all of this, keep it all straight, and know what to vote for?
You know, it's really, right now, if you think about it, you know, all of us as just viewers, how you constantly feel like you are missing out or mm-hmm. you're behind or there's all that stuff in your DVR queue that you just haven't gotten to yet. I mean, as the voters, you know, they're kind of in the same boat, but even more so because, you know, they have to try and at least keep up with this. They don't have to watch entire seasons. You know, they can watch specific episodes for these, you know, nominations, but still, there is so much out there now with, you know, Hulu, Netflix, network, cable. So, right. I mean, and to your point of how there's such a variance of shows, I mean, it's because there are so many platforms now, you know. So it's a great era for TV, but it is definitely an overwhelming era.
How does it compare to film? I mean, we see a lot of names here who on their resumes have Oscars under their belt.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it used to be that, you know, television is where you went when your film career was dead. And now it's really interesting because television seems to be a place where many people are going, you know, to kind of break into film stars or going into, to, you know, to break into kind of almost a more creative realm at this point. You know, Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Anthony Hopkins, all of these people are in shows that have been nominated this year on FX shows, on the Betty and Joan show. So it's sort of like now TV is, I wouldn't say a more prestigious platform, but it's definitely more artistically alive right now. And I think that means something.
Let's look a little bit about some of the snubs, if you will. There was some complaints that we had Modern Family is past its prime. House of Cards perhaps had its best shows a while ago, and that they should have made some room for some new stuff.
You know, one of my colleagues here called, there's certain shows with the Emmys that are the unkillables, which I love that. Modern Family being one of them, and Veep, and House of Cards. But it, yeah, sure, those are there. But I would say this year, even compared to the last few, there are definitely more newcomers. But I do think getting to that point of, you know, voters and watchers being overwhelmed, when you have a ton of choices, you tend to gravitate towards what you're familiar with because it gets so overwhelming. So sometimes I think those things like Modern Family, The Americans, whatever it is, it's a safety spot. It's like, okay, I know that. I don't know what Atlanta is, but I know what this is.
We're talking right now to Lorraine Ali. She's the television critic for the LA Times, and she's with us to talk about the 2017 Emmy nominations and how popular shows right now might say a lot about the social and political climate in the United States.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the Emmy nominations? Did your favorite shows make the cut? When you're watching a TV show on whatever platform, do you want escape and comfort, or do you want a show that speaks to what's going on in the United States, where the world is going? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation here on Central Time after this short break.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're continuing our conversation about the 2017 Emmy nominations and what they say about American society. Lorraine Ali is with us. She's TV critic for the LA Times.
You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Emmy nominated or not, what do you think are the best shows on TV? Or cable TV or streaming, however you watch TV, what is out there that you're watching, can't wait to get back to? Do you feel overwhelmed by all the shows out there and all the ways to watch them? And what is TV to you? Is it sitting down at a particular time and turning to a channel? Is it recording something? Is it streaming something? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lorraine, looking at our political climate that we're in today, do you think that it is, Emmy votes were influenced by the world we live in right now?
You know, in some cases I do. I mean, when you're looking at something like variety shows, which would be like a talk show, Stephen Colbert, Bill Maher, I definitely think, you know, the climate influenced Emmy voters on that front, because Colbert became much more politicized. Samantha Bee is one of them. So, and in the past, it's been John Oliver. So I think, yes, that has affected actually the content of the shows and how the Emmy voters felt about them. Other shows that were in development before the Trump presidency, before the current political climate, such as Handmaid's Tale, I think they kind of, you kind of see what you want to in those shows about a scary future. So I think that may have been a factor.
Well, a show that's had many decades to sink in, Saturday Night Live, nominated for 22 Emmys. Guest stars Alec Baldwin and Melissa McCarthy were nominated for awards, as well as for their portrayals of President Trump and former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer. And let's listen to a clip.
Back to James Comey. Your staff has been insisting all week that you didn't fire him because of his Russian investigation.
No, I did.
Wait, what?
I fired him because of Russia. I thought, he's investigating Russia. I don't like that. I should fire him.
And you're just admitting that?
Uh-huh.
But that's obstruction of justice.
Sure, okay.
Wait, so did I get him? Is this all over? Oh, no, I didn't. Nothing matters. Absolutely nothing matters anymore.
Look, it's simple. If the appeals court won't do what's right, President Trump will see them in court, specifically the people's court.
That isn't real.
No, that isn't real. Oh, I'm Glenn, and I'm not really.
It is real, Glenn. It says that right before East case, Glenn. It says the cases are real. The rulings are final. Don't F with me, Glenn. Next question.
So why do you think these, why do you think these sketches resonate with people?
I think they just let a lot of pressure off. I think they ease the tension because, you know, we are in such a spot where you turn on any, you know, cable news, people are like screaming at each other. It's you know, the news is just, there's so much divisiveness. And then when you just look at that, it's so ridiculous to see Melissa McCarthy as, you know, quote unquote, spicy. It just really sort of, I think, you know, alleviates some of the tension with humor. I mean, it's a basic old structure, but God, did they nail it this year.
And they certainly have the nominations to prove it.
The highest, 22. I mean, they tied with Westworld as the highest nominations in the Emmys. So, I mean, that's really quite amazing, especially considering, you know, SNL is a show that's been on for how many decades now? And, you know, to come back, like, not even come back, but just to be at the top of its game at this point, decades in, that's pretty amazing.
What do you make of political dramas like House of Cards reflecting on how people feel about the current political state?
Well, it's interesting because House of Cards, you know, again, they predate Trump. And I do think actually when House of Cards started, Trump, I think, was still with The Apprentice. So, you know, the world that they paint in there, which is just this treacherous world of, you know, in D.C. and deadly, literally, politics. You know, it's interesting. People say, gosh, they really precursed where we are now. You know, it's hard to say, you know, what chicken or egg type of thing at this point when people are watching it. Are they going, wow, this really, you know, tells me where we're at now? Or, boy, they really knew what was coming, you know? I think it definitely taps a distrust that people now have in the system of government, of things that we used to take for granted just as American democracy. And I think, you know, House of Cards really gets at that. And Veep does, too, in certain ways.
Talking right now with Lorraine Ollie. She's TV critic for the LA Times. We're talking about Emmy nominations that were announced yesterday. What to make of them, and what to make of the vast amount of TV options out there with so many different platforms now to see television? You're a critic, and I'm sure that you're able to watch these shows in your sleep, perhaps, to get them all in so you can make some judgments. How are we supposed to keep track of all the good television and know what to watch?
Oh, if I could only answer that question. You know, if I literally could just do an IV drip of the shows while I'm sleeping so I could process them. It is really tricky. You know, there's so many. Of course, there's great shows that have gotten attention. Better Call Saul, one of my favorites. Westworld, I love.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Game of Thrones, of course, which wasn't eligible for this year's Emmys. So, but then there's little show. You know, I call them little. I mean, there's great other shows that are on the network show Claws, Harlots on Hulu, which is, you know, an original series that don't get as much love, but they're still great shows because they're so many good shows. So it's really a matter of, frankly, what I do is I just tape. I tape like a mad person. And then every free moment I have, I am doing what my mom always told me not to do too much, but which is watching TV.
Well, Jody from Madison says, I love the show Call the Midwife. It's just nice to see people being nice and doing good things. Not nominated, though, Call the Midwife.
Yeah, what a beautiful show. You know, I'm not sure, you know, don't quote me on this, but I'm not sure that it qualify. It was in the years to qualify, and it has in the past.
Mm.
So, you know, I'm not sure about that. But boy, that I agree. I mean, it's an amazing show in that showing, you know, a time post-World War II, hardship, people pulling together, not too saccharine, just beautifully done. And interestingly, all about women, this group of women, which is another theme that you're seeing in a lot of the Emmy nominations this year.
Yeah, women stories, front and center. Very quickly, as we wrap up here, what do you make of that?
I think it's just, you know, kind of the natural progression right now of where there's been a lot of women's issues at the fore. And I think, you know, TV is reacting to that with these series that are really, really led by powerful women and groups of women. So it's a really nice trend to see.
And again, really quickly, what shows do you think could be the big winners this year?
Oh, I think Westworld, definitely. I think you're going to see Stranger Things going to come up with, yeah. And that's going to be the surprise because that was such a strange little show, but it's so great.
We'll hold you to it. Thank you, Lorraine. Lorraine Ollie is a TV critic for the Los Angeles Times. She joined us today to talk about the 2017 Emmy nominations and how they reflect the mood and the sentiments of our country.
When Grassland Dairy Products dropped the contracts of 75 Wisconsin farmers this spring, there was a short panic that all of those farmers were going to have to dump their milk. Almost all the farmers found buyers, and that didn't happen, but millions of gallons of milk are thrown out each year. Bridget Bowden has more on why and what happens to all that milk.
There are plenty of reasons why milk might need to be thrown out by a farmer or a milk plant. Sometimes the farmer can't find a buyer. Milk can also be contaminated by antibiotics or get too warm. At Babcock Hall Dairy Plant in Madison, manager Bill Klein says every load of milk that comes into the plant is tested for temperature in the lab.
So in this room here is where all the product, whether it's raw ingredients or raw milk or finished product, it's tested here.
And if it's above 45 degrees,
we sent it on its way. And we don't discard it ourselves, but we just tell our driver or the company that we buy the milk from that we can't accept the milk.
They also test for antibiotics.
What they do is they take a sample of the milk and they put it onto a plate like this. It incubates on here for about maybe 10 minutes or so. Once it's ready, it just goes into a reader and the reader measures it off.
State law requires plants to discard milk that has been contaminated by certain antibiotics. That's to protect consumers who may be allergic to the drugs, but also because antibiotics can inhibit the starter culture bacteria when milk is made into cheese. Steve Ingham is an administrator at the State Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. He says a milk sample from each farm is collected. Then at the milk plant, they'll test the whole load.
If the confirmation test is positive, they go back and say, okay, which farm did it come from?
And if they identify which farm caused the problem,
that farm can be on the hook for the cost of all the milk that's dumped. So one farmer messing up, you know, it can be an expensive mistake, and it's going to affect a lot of milk.
According to data from the state, milk that's dumped because of antibiotic contamination has actually gone down by about 60% in the last 10 years. Ingham says he thinks the main reason is because no one wants to bear the cost.
Dairy plants don't want to depend on farmers who mess up. Okay, so they're going to gravitate towards farmers, producers who do a good job. And from the farming point of view, you know, you don't want to make those costly mistakes.
Last year, a little more than 2 million gallons of milk from the region, including Wisconsin and Minnesota, were dumped, according to data from the Federal Milk Marketing Order. That's enough to fill 3 Olympic-sized swimming pools. But when milk is thrown away, it's not just poured down the drain.
The fats would float to the surface, and that creates that cake.
That's Brian Holmes, Professor Emeritus of Biological Systems Engineering at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says milk can actually cause farmers' wastewater systems to fail.
A drain field relies on infiltrating the water into the soil, and all those milk proteins and sugars and some of the fats will seal up the soil so that the liquid can't drain into the soil.
Often the best thing to do is to load the milk onto a manure spreader and spread it over a farm field. In some cases, it can be fed to livestock. Holmes says it's still important to be careful.
The things you need to be careful of is not applying too much too fast. In that case, you might have a runoff situation, and if it runs off and gets into a stream, then you'll be in trouble.
All in all, the amount of milk that is dumped each year is small compared to total production. Last year, Wisconsin cows produced more than 3 billion gallons of milk, second only to California. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.